Why would a skeptical medical doctor come to believe in near-death experiences?
Doctors resuscitate.
I can't be dead because I've never felt more alive.
Hogwash.
Our guest today, Dr. Michael Sabom, has been writing on and studying near-death experiences long before the popular discussions today.
She showed me the book and asked me what I thought of it. This was hogwash to me before I started looking into it.
First off, Dr. Sabom, thanks for taking the time to come on and join us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So let's go back to your story. Take us back to when maybe you didn't use the term skeptical, but you were not convinced of near-death experiences. You start off thinking there's no way these are going to be legitimate. You're a cardiologist, so you're trained to follow the empirical evidence where it leads. What was your worldview and belief system, and how long ago was kind of that state for you?
Well, Raymond Moody's book came out, Life After Life, in 1975. Two or three months after it came out, I was at the University of Florida doing my cardiology training, and there was a psychiatric social worker there, Sarah Kreisinger, and she had read the book, and we were going to a Methodist church there, the same church we were going to, and she showed me the book and asked me what I thought of it, and the only response I could give that was appropriate was hogwash. That's where I started. This was hogwash to me before I started looking into it. She wanted to present this book to a church group there in Gainesville, Florida. And I said, go ahead, Sarah, but you know, good luck. But she twisted my arm enough. What she needed from me were some patients who had had the experience to show people that it's a real live event. So she convinced me to go and talk to a few of my patients who I had resuscitated. And the third one I talked to gave me a textbook picture of the near-death experience, just as Moody had written about in his book, Life After Life. So anyway, I took that experience, went with Sarah. We talked to the church group. It was very well received. And then after that, I looked at Sarah and said, you know, maybe we ought to look into this a little bit further. Raymond, he had written a very interesting book, but it was very unscientific. Fact is, he had a statement in there at the end of his book: to all of my scientific readers, this is not a scientific study. So what I wanted to do with Sarah was to make sure that what he had done on a secular level could be shown to be true on a scientific level. So we designed a study and started interviewing patients on a regular basis. We recorded their background information. And the part of the experience that I was most interested in and spent the most time with was the out-of-body part. Because I, as a cardiologist, as you stated, am interested in empirical data of the material world to show that what these people are actually seeing during their near-death experience actually happened the way they were seeing it. So we went along for a couple of years collecting cases and writing down all the stuff. We would we would record the interviews, transcribe them. And then Sarah finished her training at the University of Florida at the same time I did. I went to Emory in Atlanta. She went to Tulane in Louisiana. And so that she's still there. She got her PhD in social work. And I continued to study in it at Emory as assistant professor of cardiology. At the end of the study, 5 years, 116 persons had been interviewed.
Wow.
And I divided the experience up into three parts because at that time there was no Grayson scale that could be applied or anything. I divided them up into what I call the autoscopic type of near-death experience, which is the autoscopic is a word that means self-visualization. And I was using that word to describe the out-of-body type experience. Then there was the transcendental part of the experience where people go down a tunnel, see a light, deceased relatives and friends, religious figures, told that it's not their time to be there, and then they come back. I was interested in the first type because the first type, these people claim to have floated up out of their bodies Yeah. Look down at what's going on in the room, could see all the things, could hear occasionally what was being said. And I, as a cardiologist, said, aha, this is a place where I can show that this really is hogwash. So okay. I started. Listen, I went into it, and I actually had people come back later after they read the book, and they would say, you know, when you interviewed me, I felt like you were trying to disprove the experience. Oh, wow. And I said, well, in a way I was. But anyway, what I found was amazing.
Now, can I jump in here for a second? Before we get to the research that you found, why were you so skeptical at that time? Why did you want to disprove it? Was it your worldview? Were you a materialist? Were you a Christian who had a certain view that science couldn't reveal this? What was the worldview why you just responded so strongly, hogwash?
I was a Christian. I was raised as Episcopalian in the church, and I certainly would say I was a Christian, but not the way I am now. I was very shallow in my belief. The main thing I was interested in at that point was hard, fast data. I was in a cardiology fellowship. I was publishing papers for medical journals, and they were interested in not somebody's experience, but what happened to the heart and all the things that goes on with the heart. And so I was very, very scientifically oriented. I would say my worldview was very scientific. And it is, to a certain extent, continued that way, except I'm now a devout Christian, and we can get into that later. But as a scientist, you know, you go up to I wasn't a materialist, but I was certainly a scientist. And I would have to say that hogwash pretty much fits what I was thinking about.
So it was less theological objections as it was that science should be rigorous, it should be empirical, and these stories cannot have any empirical evidence behind them. That was the response initially from you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You said it beautifully.
Got it. So I love it that some of the people you interviewed came back and their response was like, it felt like you were trying to disprove them, which just shows that you were approaching this with a very critical eye, not being just kind of vulnerable or gullible, so to speak. So take us back to where you were in the story. And by the way, I want viewers to make sure they realize when you're doing this, there were not books that were available on near-death experiences. There were no other doctors doing this. You were really kind of coming up with these experiences yourself and this data and a way of testing it, weren't you? This was novel.
Right. And not only me, but the people I was interviewing, they had not heard of this experience either. So this is sort of a virgin class of people who had not heard of the near-death experience. And in fact, in the movie we'll get to in a little bit, the guy that opens the movie up is just his voice and me interviewing him. But I still remember I said, have you ever told anybody about this experience? He said, I wouldn't dare. I said, why? Mm-hmm. He said, they'll think I'm crazy. He had never heard of anybody else ever having it. So Raymond Moody's book had only been out 2 or 3 months and had been published by Mockingbird Books in Covington, Georgia. I'm sure you've heard of that publisher. Okay. And on the front cover was a smashed egg with a yolk in the form of a human body. I mean, it looked like a comic book. So anyway, that being said, you're right. I mean, this is a study that cannot be repeated today. Because you could not, in this country, go up to anybody and say, ever heard of a near-death experience? Of course. I mean, it's everywhere.
It's so changed. Okay, so if people are so reluctant to tell their stories, did you say 116 or 160 people? How did you possibly find them initially to do this study over the five-year period?
Most of them were my patients. I would go in there. I was going in there. And Sarah had some, too. But most of them were mine, and they had had a cardiac arrest, or I knew of their history in their charts. So I would do all my doctor stuff. And then at the end, if they had been close to death and unconscious, I'd say, oh, by the way, did you ever have anything you remembered while you were unconscious? And they usually looked at me like, why do you want to know? And so I said, well, I'm doing this study and I'm interested in whether people could remember things or not. And anyway, that's how I approached it. Very open-ended. But there was a lot of people who were reluctant at that time, obviously, because almost all of them had not heard of the experience at all. During the later part of this study, into 4 or 5 years into the study, of course, they were learning more and more about what these things were in the public, but not then when I first started.
Okay, that's really helpful. So I want to get to your research and what, actually, let's just jump there right now. Let's talk about what you know what? I just thought of a question. Let me ask you this. We're going to come to what started to convince you, but it's somewhat amazing to me that you had 160 people in your own practice over a 5-year period that you found just by asking them these questions. That suggests this is far more prevalent than some people might think. So as you have done this research over the past few decades and talked with other cardiologists, are you an outlier or are you hearing others say, no, we have the same experience with our patients?
No, I was an outlier. Fact is, I was assistant professor of medicine. I actually published some journal articles. The book Recollections of Death was reviewed in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the number one medical journal in the world, gave it a real positive review. And I'd written articles for JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association. None of that counted towards me becoming an associate professor of medicine from the assistant professor level. This was not recognized as legitimate research, period.
Okay.
So anyway, that's very true. I forgot your other question.
Oh, so I guess what I'm getting at is if you had that many number of patients, just yourself from asking it, it doesn't seem that they would all have lined up and just been your patients, and that other cardiologists, if they leaned in, would also have a lot more patients. Is that the case as you've spoken to other cardiologists?
Okay. There were two groups of patients. Maybe I was a little misleading at first. First of all, it's 116, not 60.
Okay.
Secondly, there's two groups of those. Those were the prospectively interviewed patients. Those were my patients, and I had no idea whether they had a near-death experience prior to interviewing. And then I was being referred patients by other doctors once over the 5 years they learned what I was about. Somebody would come up and say, hey, you need to go talk to this guy. I think he has something to say. So anyway, there was a referred group, but I kept them separate because the methodology was different in the two groups.
Okay, so the data I see will typically say about 4 to 5% of the population have had some kind of near-death experience. Would your research kind of roughly line up with that if you had to guess and estimate? Does that strike you as accurate?
Probably, yes. Although, I had a lot higher level. I'm not sure why. Well, I have some inclinations, but that's really getting in the weeds. Yeah, that's probably overall. I think 10 to 15% has been the usual standard frequency of these experiences.
Okay, so let's get back to skeptical cardiologist in the 70s doing this novel research, trying to show that it's hogwash. Start to walk us through some of the things that made you pause and go, wait a minute, there might be more to this than I realized.
Okay, well, as I mentioned before, the out-of-body part of it, I would begin the interview by saying, what do you remember? And I'd shut up and let them just go free narrative. And then once they had finished that, I'd come back and ask them detailed questions. Well, you said you saw, for instance, the monitor over to the side of your bed while the cardioversion was going on. I can understand that. Yes, there was a monitor there. Did you see anything on the monitor? What did you see? What details did you see? And I had a guy actually, these old time cardioverter machines, they had a fixed needle and a moving needle on a little screen on the machine itself. And that was the way they charged it. And this guy watched these needles go back and forth while he was out of his body. He gave me a very detailed description of this old machine and the way it worked. It was the details. It's very important to get the details because you can't, it's not like, well, I saw a bunch of doctors standing around. The nurse was over there and they were doing some things to my body. And yeah. And sure. Then I woke up. Okay. That the 30 out of body experiences that I had, only 6 were what I consider detailed and unique enough so that it would convince me, not convince me, but over a period of time it did, that this was something different. The other 24 were general impressions of what was going on. And when I nailed them down, what they said was accurate, but it was accurate in a general way. So I discounted that. Okay. I wanted detailed, unique. And then the other thing that's important was I was very, and I continue to be very adamant about documentation. Mm-hmm. These things had to be documented. It wasn't that somebody saw this. It had to be somebody, there needed to be medical records or somebody that was there, i.e. medical personnel, who could then tell me exactly what had happened. So I had a third-party documentation, which, by the way, is sorely lacking in these experiences then and now. And I think it really detracts from the scientific quality of a lot of these studies.
That specificity is really helpful because it's not that the 24 you describe out of the 30 didn't have an out-of-body experience. It's that we just can't confirm it. But that when someone starts, right, that's the distinction of why you trust some. Okay.
Yeah.
So some of these details gave you pause going, wait a minute, he's not only describing a meter, but specific ways it went up and down that matched exactly what happened. When this person was in a state of what? What state was this person in where they should not have been? Was it no brain waves? Was it no heart waves? Like what physical state were they in while they come back and report these things?
Well, the nice thing about a true cardiac arrest, which is ventricular fibrillation or straight line asystole, the nice thing about that, within somewhere around 10 to 15 seconds, you have a flat EEG. There have been multiple studies to show that. So these people, I had the rhythm. I knew what the rhythm was, and I could then infer what the brain was doing at the time. Of course, they were unconscious too. That was true then, and it's true now. During a cardiac arrest, your brain waves are flat in 15 seconds. With flat brain waves, you're not able to perceive visually anything with your physical eyes. And these people were telling me what they were seeing. Now, we do know that hearing is one of the last things to go, and sometimes they can hear in there, but it's the sight. It's the visual descriptions of things that were really important to me. And they had we didn't have an EEG machine on them at the time, although that's being tried now. But we do know that it takes several minutes to get in there and start resuscitating somebody, even in the coronary care unit at that time. So they had flat brain waves for large percentage of the time. And then you could use what's called time anchors. In other words, if they said they saw somebody do such and such, or this happened, this, for instance, that cardioverter machine, those things are not charged until they're ready to shock the patient. You don't just charge them, because once they're charged, those things are dangerous. You could shock somebody else. So you need to discharge it on the patient. You know, at the time, if he was seeing that monitor go, that was at a time when his heart was out, flatlined. And so that's kind of how you can put all this together.
Now, one of the cases I saw you refer to kind of in an interview online was of Pam Reynolds. And this is one that was particularly kind of pointed to you and a part of your kind of conversion, so to speak, to believing in these. Tell us a little bit about that account and why it was so impactful to you.
Yeah, but this was during my second study, and this was published in Light and Death, 1998. Pam, in 1991 or so, was found to have a giant cerebral aneurysm. That's the bubble off the side of the artery in the brain. And it was located at the base of the brain, so they could not just go in there and take it out. We had several surgeons here in Atlanta look at her. They said, no, we're not touching her. The problem is that's a very thin-walled aneurysm. When they're going in there and digging around, they're very likely to puncture it, and then it's all over with. So they flew her out to Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, where Dr. Spetzler was doing this cutting-edge surgery called hypothermic cardiac arrest. In that situation, what they do is bring the patient into the operating room, put them on the table, they take their eyes shut, they put earbuds in both ears that are emitting 95 decibel clicks to check the brainstem to make sure it also is dead. They have her hooked up to an EEG. They put her on a cardiopulmonary bypass machine, and then they begin to lower the body temperature at some point. But before that, they have to open up the skull and expose the aneurysm, at which point they lower the body temperature to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which is real, you know, 98 is normal, 60 degrees. And then they raise the head of the bed. They turn off the cardiopulmonary bypass machine, and all the blood drains out of her head. Now, when I first heard about this experience, I thought this was Twilight Zone. I mean, I'd never heard of this before. I was more impressed with the experience of the procedure than I was of her experience. So I talked to Spetzler, got all of her medical records. This is the number one best documented case on record. The reason is everything in her body was monitored. They had temperature gauges. They had EEG machines. They had these things in her ears. Their eyes were taped shut. All of this. And under those conditions, she heard a convert. She had an out-of-body experience. And she had a, she recalled a conversation between the surgeon and the cardiovascular surgeon down, putting in the bypass machine in her femoral arteries. There was some problems down there, and she could remember the words and what they had said. She also identified, and this really got me too. She identified, she said, yeah, and I saw that thing he was holding in his hand. I said, well, what did it look like? That was the bone saw. Okay. I didn't know what it looked like either. So I wasn't influencing her because I had to actually go to the company and find out what it looked like. She said it was looked like an electric toothbrush. At which time I said, yep, okay. And I recorded the rest of the interview and put it in the drawer. This is called the drawer effect. In other words, I didn't know what to do with it because this is not, the bone saw is not an electric toothbrush, okay? So a year later, I transcribed the interview and I had to go ahead and find out what the bone saw looked like. So I contacted the Midas Rex company in Fort Worth, Texas. They sent me a booklet and pictures of this. And I have it in the book, Light and Death, to have the picture. It looks like an electric toothbrush.
Wow.
So she also saw the equipment table, and she said that all these attachments to the bone saw look like the socket wrench set that her father used to have in the garage. And sure enough, that's exactly what it looks like. And a picture of that is in the book. So she was seeing things that she had never seen before, she'd never heard of before, and I'd never seen before, and I'd never heard of before. So anyway, this is kind of like, is showing, so it answers some of the when you're interviewing somebody, sometimes you lead them to what you want them to say.
Sure,
I was not leading her. She was leading me, and I had to prove or to myself that that was accurate. She then went down a tunnel, saw a light, and had what's called a transcendental near-death experience. And then at the end of that, when the surgery was over, 6 hours later, she came back and watched her body be defibrillated again. They had to shock her heart back to normal rhythm at the end of the procedure. But the thing about this is almost like an experiment. If you wanted to do an experiment to show a near-death experience under all these conditions being monitored, this was it. There was nothing else to monitor. And so this has received, obviously, international attention, yeah, both positively and negatively.
Sure.
People who cannot accept the fact that there's more than just the physical brain there can't get over it. And they come up with the most ridiculous reasons why to disprove this. And I don't want to keep going on about this, but there's an anesthesiologist in Germany. His name is Gerald Worley, and he's a nice guy. And I've communicated with him quite a bit. I like the guy, but you know, I go through all this with him, and he said, "Well, you know, I know what happened." And I said, "Okay, well, tell me what happened." He said, "When they were talking, the surgeon with the other surgeon down by the legs, that the airwaves and the vibrations of their voice was going through the air, going down to the operating room table, traveling up to her head, going through her skull, going through the metal thing that was holding her skull still, and she heard it through bone conduction and not air conduction. Now, you may not know the difference. Air conduction is you and I talking right now. Bone conduction is you can actually close your ear, external auditory canals, and you can conduct sounds through the bones of your head. It bypasses the external ear. This was so ridiculous that, I mean, I just had to, I said, really? Do you have some evidence that this actually could happen? So this is how extreme this case is. Other people got involved in this too, and they invited Worley over to Phoenix, Arizona from Germany to put him on the operating room table to reenact everything. They obviously didn't open up his skull, but sure, to reenact him to see if he could hear somebody talking in the room by the vibrations going through the operating room table. Well, of course, he didn't pick him up on it. But, I mean, that's how extreme this is getting. There's no explanation for what happened to her, except the explanation that somehow there is something more than just our physical brain that perceives things.
You know, for near-death experiences to be real, all we need is one. We don't need two. We don't need hundreds. All we need is one. If Pam Reynolds' story is legitimate, then we are more than just our brains. But with that said, I'm just curious, if you could put an estimate on, of those you've personally studied, you've personally done the experiments on, or those you've read about, how many do you feel like are strongly warranted? Maybe not to the level of Pam Reynolds because of all the evidence that was there and the way it's been studied, but some you would say, these are strongly warranted. Couple dozen, few hundred, how many do you think could be supported in that way?
Well, I've been criticized. They say, oh, you only have six cases of your, and you're right. That one case, that's what's known as a white crow. It's if you wanted to prove that all crows were black, you don't need to prove they're all white. All you need to do is to prove one is white.
Yep.
Thus, all are not black. This is the white crow case of Pam Reynolds. But to answer your question, I will have to say that I was in a very, I won't say chosen position, but favorable position to get the documentation as a cardiologist. And even I wouldn't have known about her unless I was a doctor. So most of the people who are writing about this are psychologists or academics who using other people's data to come up with explanations, et cetera. And they're also, and I have to be careful because I don't want to talk down to the methodology used by these other people, but I'm very strict on documentation with third-party reliable documentation. And it's just not my opinion. There was two articles written in the 1990s by Ian Stevenson, who is the founder of all this at the University of Virginia. And he wrote these articles, and he individually himself went to people who claimed to have had a near-death experience and had been very near-death at the time, pulled their medical records, and he found that 55% of the people who think they were near-death were not near-death at the time they had the experience. So that means that if you don't document what's going on, then you don't. Bad data leads to bad results. You can't get good results out of bad data.
Well, that's fair. I appreciate your careful kind of methodology here to not just accept what others say, but do the data yourself. So the story of Pam Reynolds is in the 1990s, your second study. Let's go back to the first. You have at least these six cases of the 30 that give specificity and are enough to convince you there's something legitimate here. This couldn't be chance or some other naturalistic explanation. Now, if these folks were somewhat hesitant to often share, were you like, I've got this data, proclaim it to the world? Were you like, my reputation could be marred if I speak this? How and when did you speak out once you were convinced that this is true?
Well, when I had all the data, and by the way, in the 119 persons in the study, I collected over 3,000 bits of data and then statistically analyzed them in the appendix of the book. So I was presenting this stuff as a scientific study, and I had actually envisioned this book to last a long time with this data, because somebody could go to my book and they're all anonymous in the book. They didn't want to be identified, and I didn't want them identified.
Sure.
But you could pick up all the information. You could reconstruct where the person was from, how much education they had, what kind of religious background. I mean, all this stuff is in the book, and you can reconstruct the patient with the experience. So I didn't, once I found this stuff, the people over me, and this was at Emory. Once I was at Emory for 5 years, and then I went into private practice in Atlanta. And Emory was very nice. They let me do the study, et cetera. Okay. But I certainly was not recognized for it. I didn't really care, because I was finding something that I had the data. If they wanted to go back and look at what I'd found and documented it, they could either call me a liar or go find out for themselves. So that sort of was my attitude. I was kind of immune to this. Plus, you got to realize, as this experience became more and more known in this country, people became very interested in it, very excited. So I would say that I would think that there's more. I wish there were more skeptics out there, because skepticism leads to knowledge, if it's true skepticism and not just ideology, i.e. I know everything's material. Don't tell me about it. That's ideology. But true skepticism means that, you know, I don't believe it, but I'll at least take a look at it. So, you know, I think that's healthy. And I said that in that movie too. So
yeah, you anyway. Did. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the movie After Death, which I just think is fantastic. Watched it with my 11-year-old son. It's one of the best high produced accounts of near death experiences. But let's go back to when you first published the book in what year?
1982 was the first. The second was 1998.
So 1982, you first published it. And there was almost nothing out at this point. Tell me a little bit about the reception. Did you have people go, I want to hear more? Tell me about this. Were you just kind of like John the Baptist in the wilderness trying to get people to pay attention to this? What was the reception like at that point in the early 80s?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Once I published the book, I didn't publicize it. Harper & Row was a big publishing company. They sent me on a week-long book tour in America, and I hit all these shows. And then I came back, and I went into private practice, and then I was buried in cardiology. I didn't have any time to promote it. So it basically is word of mouth, the book. But I forget what your question is, how people receive the book. I think people who actually looked at it from a truly skeptical standpoint were impressed. And one of the reasons I say that is I got it reviewed by the New England Journal of Medicine. I don't think they've reviewed any other books of near-death experiences, even up to today. I don't know that as a fact, but I was very happy to do that. Because those people don't mess around. That is empirical data or garbage can. I mean, that's the way they treat it. And I thought the guy treated it really very fairly. But that wasn't the only journal. I was getting very good reviews on this book if people took the time to read it. So I felt good about how it was received.
I think
because I was skeptical before I even started it. So how can I blame somebody else for thinking this hogwash until they look into it?
That's totally fair. So you publish this in 82, do a tour in the U.S., dive back into cardiology. What motivated you to write a second book and dive into further research? And maybe how was that study different than the first one?
The study was not different than the first one. The methodology was the same. I added a couple of other ways of evaluating different spiritual issues, but my first book was pure medical. There was no theology or spiritual discussion in the book whatsoever. What happened in the early 1990s, I don't know if you remember, you may not be old enough, but there was an author, I think she's still alive, Betty Eady. She published a book, I think it was in 1991 or so, and it was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 58 weeks in a row.
Goodness.
That's got to be a record. But it goes to show you what happened. There was a big spiritual shift to the interpretation of the experience away from the pure science and medical part of it. So Betty Eady is a new age person all the way. And I don't know if you know Doug Ruthies.
Doug's a friend.
Doug wrote a wonderful book. It's entitled Deceived by the Light in 1995. He had a lot of my stuff in there too. But I need to meet Doug sometime. But anyway, I in my upcoming book, I'm going to be using quotes out of that book a lot. Good. But people like him, they were pointing out that these people were using this experience and showing that it's that universalism or New Age stuff or the Eastern religions or reincarnation. Raymond Moody got into the psychomantium, occult sort of things. And I was seeing that shift. So I figured what I wanted to do is to do another study with more of a spiritual interest, focus. And so I did that. And it just so happened as I was doing that, the Pam Reynolds case came along too.
Gotcha.
So I mean, Pam's case is, I don't use it. I think she was Christian, but that's not why. Not the thing that was different than anybody else who had the experience. But anyway, it was a big focus off the Christian view. They were using it to, one of the biggest well, if we want to get into this now, one of the biggest problems, I think, with this experience itself is that it really is it's a universalist experience. In other words, and I don't know if you know the difference between general revelation and special revelation. Okay.
Yep.
Well, this is the general revelation event. The law of God is written on the hearts of all people, Romans 2. And all people have these experiences, whether they're Buddhists or atheists or, you know, true Christians. So they were using these experiences as afterlife experiences, as proof that, guess what? There's no need for Jesus Christ. Christianity is a nice sounding religion, but I've got my own nice sounding religion. And by the way, these ministers of the Christian beliefs have the same experiences I have. So why do I need to go through the problem of learning the Bible and all that? So anyway, it was being used as a counter-Christian
gotcha.
Thing. So I came out with Light and Death, and I had some findings there that suggested that this could be understood within the Christian religion, and it actually supported. I had some people who had near-death experiences who were Christians before they had the experience, and this deeply and this much this solidified their faith because it's a spiritual experience. It's a powerful experience. And if you're a Christian, it's a spiritual experience that leads you towards Christ and not towards universalism. But if you're not a Christian to begin with, then the general revelation is there is a God, but there's many ways to God, and my way is as good as your way. So I sort of lost my train of thought there.
No, that's great. I was asking about some of the differences between the two studies. We won't necessarily go down the train of like the universalism, et cetera. Steve Miller, as you know, you mentioned you watched a couple of my interviews with him, has a recent book out, and we talked about this probably 2 or 3 months ago, offering specific responses to this in a way that I think is really helpful. So I will direct people to his book, to that interview. But since your methodology was the same in the early 80s and the early 90s, was the data basically the same? Was there the same support for near-death experiences, interpretation aside, in your second study?
Yes. I had an appendix, and I had what I was interested in there more was belief in God before and after, belief in the afterlife. Okay. Before and after, and statistically analyze this. And believe me, across the board, the belief in a God and a master of the universe, as A.J. Ayer, who's a big famous atheist of the 20th century, he had a near-death experience, but he says, I'm still an atheist. This was not God. This was master of the universe. He described God, but he wouldn't use the word God. So anyway, that was universal. That is universal. That's Romans 2. That's written on everybody's heart. And I think this experience brings that out in people, and they do become more spiritual in a general sense.
That's really helpful. Now, you asked about my dad kind of when we were chatting before this interview started, and he's 84 years old. He was doing apologetics before anybody today was doing apologetics. So some of the questions I love asking him is how he's seen this entire conversation culturally change and how apologetics is done differently today than it was in the past. There's just very few people alive who have that perspective. You were doing studies on near-death experiences before it was cool. Now there's a lot of books, there's a lot of authors, there's research, there's this new documentary that's out again called After Death that I just think is fantastic. Maybe you've answered this to some degree, but can you tell us just kind of from a 30,000 foot view perspective, how has the study and or reception of near-death experiences changed in the 45 plus years that you've been tracking and doing research in it?
Well, the obvious change is more people know about it. And I think it's, I think the emphasis both within research of this experience and in the general public is not whether it happens or not. I think unless you've really been buried in an island somewhere off the coast of somewhere, you know that it's there. Okay. Hmm. It's the interpretation of it. I don't think the interpretation had, and it's interesting because the book that I'm writing, I've been toying around with titles for it. And one title that really is attractive to me is The Near-Death Experience, The Three Battlegrounds. There are three battlegrounds of the near-death experience.
Okay.
The first battleground is the materialist, scientific, there's nothing that leaves your body. That's not there. That's the scientific on the conscious level. On the subconscious level, which we really don't have time to get into, but there's a psychological component subconsciously where it modifies the original experience into something else, which shows that you absolutely need documentation of what you see and don't assume that what you see is really what you think it is. And the final battleground is a spiritual battleground, Christianity versus the other religions. Mm. So what I'm trying to do is bring them all three together. But it's a real challenge because people are entrenched in their beliefs. But I think that it's really something that needs to be done because, as when we first started, a non-Christian will most likely remain a non-Christian after a near-death experience. And quite frankly, I'm a co-founder of IANS, International Association of Near-Death Studies. Mm. And that the general gist, I'm one of the few outspoken Christians within that organization. Now, it's worldwide now. It has a symposium every year and et cetera. It really supports research into the near-death experience. But the religious interpretation of it, fact is, after my second book, people read it, and there's a Journal of Near-Death Studies that this organization represents, too, and it's a peer-reviewed journal. It's very good. But the title of this group of studies in response to light and death was that I had started religious wars within the near-death studies, field of near-death studies. And so I did. And I was writing journal articles right and left defending Christianity on this because we have our beliefs. I believe sincerely that the Bible is a word of God. It's inerrant. And quite frankly, if there's a question about whether some part of this experience is right or wrong, I go to the Bible first as the final authority. And that doesn't sit well with people who are not Christians.
I could see that. So, okay. So obviously when you started, there was not this International Association of Near-Death Studies. Now there is. So that's one shift, the amount of study, the amount of attention to it. You said that it shifted in the sense that people doubted these things happened. Now we know they happened. Just how do we interpret it? Are there any atheists in the International Association of Near-Death Studies? You described A.J. Ayer, who is an atheist who had a near-death experience. Are there any materialists? Or are they all just other religions or kind of New Age and a handful are Christians?
Well, New Age and Eastern people, they aren't materialists. So we get it's composed of a lot of them. As far as true atheists, which I think is fairly rare, no, because they may throw stones at what's being written, but they're not a member of it. And A.J. Ayer, as I guess you know, is a poster child for an atheist who had a near-death experience and described it, but refused to call it God.
So different near-death studies experts have different opinions upon what we can draw from near-death studies. I've had John Burke on, I've had Steve Miller on. this is a topic I find myself going back to. I'm curious, as a scientist, what do you think we can draw apart from going to scripture? What can we draw fairly and logically from near-death experiences themselves?
Okay, what we can draw fairly and logically without scripture from the near-death experience is that the dying process is a process and not a single moment in time. And that's been shown both medically and biblically. And during that dying process, there is an entity of extra bodily, they call it non-local consciousness, that leaves the body and can actually visualize what's going on. That's the secular view of the soul leaving the body. But I think that conclusion can be drawn, Bible aside. I mean, that's from the observations that that have been made. And anyway, I think to say, well, that's not true, is going now in the face of 30 years of published scientific research. So, I mean, I just think that's the materialist dualist argument. And I don't really think we'll ever get away from that, but I think this has made a big dent in that. And in the books that now come out, that JP and Gary Habermas write a lot of chapters in, that is the near-death experience is what they point to as the example that dualism is true. That is a soul in a body and not just the body alone.
Yeah, J.P. Morland does. In fact, he makes an interesting principle argument that if we talk about the body being separated from the soul, then we already recognize that they're not the same things.
Right.
Inherently, to even have whether your soul can get separated from your body is a separate question from the idea of body being separated from the soul just being a plausible idea implies that body and soul are not the same. And works in favor of dualism. But then if we have evidence, like you've described and you document, that a sort of consciousness survives outside of the body, then that's also a case for dualism in a sense. So I think it works on two levels. Does it matter?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's a very important point here that if the soul does leave the body, if there's some non-local consciousness that leaves the body, I'm a proponent that's during the process of dying before final biological death. These are not after death experiences. They're before death spiritual extra bodily experiences. So, and that's where I part ways with a lot of people, including Christians. The whole heaven tourism genre of books is people having these experiences and going to heaven, walking down the golden path up to the throne of God, all this, that's after death. That's not during the process of dying. So I'm pretty solid on that view. The problem is medicine cannot define the absolute point of death, and the Bible can't. And I can use a lot of references, but we just don't have time, that this is That's a fine. Process and not a moment in time. So there is a gray zone. And so this is where the argument between Christians comes. When somebody says, in this gray zone, I actually went to heaven and saw all this stuff up there in heaven, like as if it's out of Revelation.
Is this a part of your personal journey? Because you described back in 1975, you would have been a Christian, but not the kind you are today. Was studying near-death experiences a part of becoming the kind of Christian you are today, or was there something else that caused that in your life?
Well, it happened. The cause and effect. I'm sure I'm studying this as a spiritual endeavor, and I think that is much enhanced by the near-death experience work.
Does your work in here, last question related to this, does your work on near-death experiences and talk with people who've gone through them, scripture aside, shape the way you face and think about death?
No. Well, I consciously, I don't. Actually, I remember a sentence that I wrote at the end of an article in the Journal of Near-Death Studies that I believe in life after death, but not based upon the near-death experience, but based upon the Word of God and my Christian beliefs. And I think that that's where my stake in the ground is put. The near-death experience is consistent with, but it's not proof of, the Word of God is proof of.
Oh, that's really interesting. Now I see where some of the debate is amongst Christians and how they interpret these. So this could be a piece of evidence towards a dualistic worldview, but evidence after death, you would point towards something else to prove it or demonstrate it. Okay.
But to have something else go after death implies the fact that you need something to go there, a dualist situation, so the soul can break off of the physical body, which we know is in the ground.
Okay. That's helpful. So this lines up with and gives support for a biblical view of what it means to be human as body and soul, but you would point towards elsewhere, maybe scripture, the resurrection, etc., to demonstrate your belief in life after death.
Right.
Is that fair? Okay. All right. Good stuff. I said it was the last question, but I do have one more for you. Your book, would it matter if you published it in a popular Christian publishing house? Do you want to publish it in a secular or an academic place? Would an academic publisher potentially accept a book of this sort?
I don't know. Oxford does. I mean, Habermas and Moreland have written stuff in those books that are pretty Christian. I will probably not have to, but my first shot would be, you know, Harper and Row was the first book. Harper Collins was the second book, because Harper and Row didn't exist anymore. I'll probably go back to Harper Collins as the third, when I write the third book. And I've got somebody involved who was my agent before, and he knows people at Harper Collins. So that's probably where I'm going. Now, they do publish Christian books, but they aren't solely a Christian publisher.
Yeah, that makes sense. Both Thomas Nelson that published Evidence Demands a Verdict and Zondervan that published my more recent book are owned by HarperCollins.
Right.
But there's something about a book like this, not with a distinct Christian publisher, that might appeal to a wider audience. So there's different strengths you can make, but I was just curious what you're thinking in that regard.
Well, that's a good question. I think the first two parts will appeal to most people, and they'll probably just cut off the third part.
Okay.
I mean, I'm serious. That is what happened. But that will deter, and I will see, as After Death Movie has seen, that it's just too Christian. It's for the Christian people. If you're not Christian, you're not going to, you know, that's a,
yeah.
I don't consider that a criticism, but, it's a point at which can be attacked by non-Christians.
That's fair. It's a different focus, I think, is the key, and there's a place for both. You've mentioned a few times the movie After Death. The movie starts with you interviewing somebody in there. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Some of the producers and directors of the show sent me a link. I watched it with my 11-year-old and just walked away. It created such good conversation with us. Tell us your thoughts on that film, especially since you started in 1970, in the late 70s, seeing a film like this come full circle. What does that movie mean to you?
Well, I think it was beautifully done as far as the people they had on it and the cinematography. As a Christian, it's almost like it gets people interested in after death. Is there after death? Is there afterlife? I think that's good. That generates interest. It's almost like pre-evangelism, if you want to use that term. Sure. But it doesn't answer the question of, well, now that you're after death, what then? You know, And I had a little bit of a reservation about the title of the movie, After Death.
Oh, gotcha.
Because, as I just said, yeah, I think they're near-death experiences and not after-death experiences. And to the producer's credit, they allowed me to say that. They didn't cut it out twice in the movie. I said, these are near-death, not after-death experiences.
Yeah, I recall you making
a little bit of confusion there, but anyway, overall, I thought it was very well done.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it that really captures visually and also the key stories and key players in this field over the past few decades. I was blown away, and I would definitely recommend for my viewers to go check out. I've done probably 4 or 5 videos on near-death experiences, and they get great response. It just fascinates people. Well, we're talking about here, if you want to see Pam Reynolds and you want to see some of these other folks and John Burke and some of these key players weigh into this together in Hollywood, you know, level documentary, check out After Death. I loved it. Dr. Sabom, keep me on the list. When your book is, I'm guessing when you finish it and publish it, we're a couple of years out, but we would love to have you back on to explore this further, spread the word, really appreciate what you're doing, appreciate your skeptical, in the right sense of the term, and rigorous methodological approach to this. Don't want to be taken in by hogwash. As an apologist, I appreciate that. It speaks well to you, but also to the evidence for near-death experiences. So thanks for coming on. Before I let you go, if you want to study apologetics, this is a topic I actually cover in my class on the resurrection. We walk through some of the evidences for near-death experiences. There's information below at Bio. We have the top-rated Masters in Apologetics. It's a fully distanced program. And Mike, you'd find this interesting. We have every profession, including some of the top-rated doctors in the world, medical doctors, have actually taken our apologetics program, which is really humbling. So information is below. Dr. Sabom, thanks again for coming on.
Okay, thanks, Sean. Have a great one. Thank you very much.